Order, end of question time. The clerk will now read the orders of the day and the notices of motions.
Item 1, Maintenance of Racial Harmony Bill, second reading.
Minister for Home Affairs, Leader of the House.
Mr. Speaker, sir, I believe that the next item on the order paper, which is the maintenance of the Racial Harmony Bill, as well as the second item, the Constitution of the Republic of Singapore Amendment Bill, will be moved by the Minister for Home Affairs. Mr. Speaker, and I believe he will also be asking for them to be debated together. Mr. Speaker, may I seek your consent and the general assent of members present to move that the proceedings on the item under discussion be exempted from the provisions of Standing Order No. 48-8 to remove the time limit in respect of the Minister for Home Affairs speeches.
I give my consent. Does the Leader of the House have the general assent of honourable members present to so move? Leader, please proceed.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the proceedings on the item under discussion be exempted from the provisions of Standing Order No. 48-8 to remove the time limit in respect of the Minister for Home Affairs speeches.
The question is, as moved by the Leader of the House, those who agree say aye. Those who disagree say no. I think the ayes have it. Minister for Home Affairs.
Mr. Speaker, sir, thank you. I beg to move that the bill be now read a second time. And I will refer to this bill as the RH bill, short for Racial Harmony. And it's somewhat similar sounding to the Religious Harmony Act, which we passed some time ago. So this bill is linked to the next bill, the Constitution of the Republic of Singapore Amendment Bill, and the latter amends the President's powers under the Constitution to give effect to the proposals in this bill. And so I seek your permission to debate both bills together.
Please proceed.
We will, of course, take the Constitution Bill through its formal stages separately later. And thank you, sir. At present, dealing with the RH bill, there are powers to deal with conduct which threatens racial harmony. But what you see is that they are found in different pieces of legislation. What this bill does is to bring those powers together in one place. And so in that sense, it consolidates. And at the same time, of course, by presenting it in this form, we seek to affirm the importance of racial harmony in Singapore. And, you know, based on the responses we have had from members of the public when we did our consultations and when we put out the bill, I want to make one point. This bill is not a panacea for all racial issues. You cannot by law force people of different races to get along with one another, nor can you prevent insensitivity or racial slights from happening in everyday interactions by passing a law. That we try to deal with, try and improve conduct, try and get people together through a variety of policies and platforms which promotes social cohesion, racial harmony. That's a huge part of it. The law can set out a framework as to what you can't do. Sir, with your permission, can I ask the clerks to distribute Annex 1?
Go ahead.
Members can also access this material through the parliamentary app. The point that has been made by MHA through its press release, which I'm sure the members who are intending to speak on the bill would have looked at, which I would emphasize again, and you will see it from Annex 1, is that most of the proposals in this bill, certainly the substantive proposals, are not new. Right? And that's, so as long as members understand we are consolidating from different pieces of legislation. So when you express your concerns and so on, in a way, what you need to understand is if you have those concerns, then they would have existed for a very long time, because this bill doesn't, in that sense, create new provisions in a substantive manner. There are some new provisions, and you can see that in the bill and in the press releases. But I'm referring to the substantive provisions. The table in Annex also provides a comparative reference between this bill and the Maintenance of Religious Harmony Act, which I would call the MRHA, as well as other legislation. For example, Part 2 of the bill on the Presidential Council for Racial and Religious Harmony takes reference from the current Presidential Council for Religious Harmony. Part 3 of the bill on restraining orders against racial content and Part 4 of the bill on measures against foreign influence also are similar to the MRHA. Part 6 of the bill on offences relating to race, and those are what I call the charging provisions, they bring over the existing offences from the Penal Code. So in the course of bringing in concepts and provisions from other existing legislation, we have made some refinements to some provisions for clarity and effectiveness, and I'll explain that later. So first, I think the bill itself is fairly clear-cut, but why such a bill? Why do we need this? It's not usual in many countries. I think that's a more fundamental, more important question. That is because we have always treated racial harmony as being fundamental in Singapore. And so this bill has to be seen in that context. Multiracialism underpinned by racial harmony is a foundational principle for us. So as members, most members will know, when Singapore gained independence, the issues relating to racial relations were fresh in the minds of the first generation of leaders. The proximate cause were the racial riots of 1964, and at that time, communal tensions were very high in both Singapore and Malaysia. On 21 July 1964, riots started. That was during a procession to celebrate Prophet Muhammad's birthday. A glass bottle was thrown into a crowd. The crowd had about 20,000 Malay celebrants. There was then an angry exchange between Malays in the crowd and some Chinese bystanders. That resulted in violence. The violence spread all across Singapore. That was a state of the tensions at that point. It lasted 17 days for the situation to stabilize. 23 people died, more than 400 were injured. Then violence broke out again, riots broke out again on 2nd of September 1964. Between, again, Malays and Chinese. That happened after a Malay trishaw driver was killed. And the second time round, it took 12 days before calm was established. 13 people had died, more than 100 injured. The broader context for those tensions were the arguments between Singapore and Malaysia. These arguments had led to Singapore's, or these arguments then led to Singapore's separation from Malaysia. Singapore's merger into the Federation of Malaysia in 1963 had raised some very fundamental issues, because the new state of Malaysia in 1963 had Malays, Chinese, Indians, Eurasians, amongst others, and there were basic differences between Singapore and KL on how the state was to be organized, and in particular the approach towards multiracialism. Singapore wanted racial equality. KL favoured race-based politics. The two approaches were not reconcilable. And the idea of a Malaysian militia, advocated by Singapore, brought about a very strong counter from UMNO leaders in Malaysia, in KL, in Malaya. They saw this as a challenge to Malay dominance. And Singapore then became an independent country. And on the day of our independence, 9th of August, 1965, Mr. Lee said, and these are very important words, he famously said, and I quote, "We are going to have a multiracial nation in Singapore. We will set the example. This is not a Malay nation. This is not a Chinese nation. This is not an Indian nation. Everybody will have his place, equal language, culture, religion." These issues and the approaches exercised the minds of Mr. Lee and his generation. The problems were seared into their minds. They had grown up in a Malaya where different races had lived together for generations as colonial subjects. Once independence was achieved, first in the Federation of Malaya in 1957, and then in Malaysia in 1963, the question immediately arose as to whether all citizens, regardless of their race, were to have equal status. Our founding leaders had seen how fragile a multiracial society could be. They wanted, as far as possible, to make Singapore a more racially equal society. And that involved many tough decisions. For instance, the languages we speak. Some major Chinese organizations asked Mr. Lee to make Chinese our only official language and the language of business. Mr. Lee refused. He said on 3rd of October 1965 that although in Singapore 75% of the population is Chinese and the Malays form only 12%, never mind, Malay has become our national language. Yet Malay language, Chinese, Tamil and English are all equal. The four official languages were given recognition by the Republic of Singapore Independence Act and also in the Constitution. Another example, one of the first few constitutional amendments our first generation of leaders made was to create the Presidential Council for Minority Rights, chaired by the Chief Justice. I'll call it PCMR. The PCMR can veto any legislation that Parliament passes that it feels affects the rights and privileges of minorities in Singapore. There were several other steps that were taken to focus on a Singaporean identity which would transcend race and religion. It was an act of tremendous courage on the part of those leaders to do all of this. I mean, it would have been far easier for them to have said, okay, in Singapore, Chinese will be the sole official languages, and the Chinese will have several other legally recognized privileges. If you see the situation in advanced developed countries, if you go to Germany, you have to speak German by and large. If you go to France, you have to speak French. If you go to UK, you generally have to speak English. So it would have been very natural for some to have said in Singapore, Chinese should be the language of business and language of commerce and language of government. But we took a different path. Over the years, our insistence on maintaining racial and religious harmony and our zero tolerance for bigotry and hatred has made Singapore a very different place compared with others. So if you look at a 2023 Gallup World Poll, 92% of respondents in Singapore said that Singapore was a good place to live in for racial minorities. We were ranked first out of over 130 countries and territories for this question. Another global survey by Pew in 2021 found that 92% of respondents in Singapore think that having people of different backgrounds, including racial backgrounds, makes Singapore a better place to live in. The government also periodically conducts domestic surveys on racial and religious harmony in Singapore, and so do non-government entities. So most recently, in August of last year, my ministry and MDDI polled more than 1,000 Singapore residents on their sentiments towards racial harmony. With your permission, sir, Mr. Speaker, may I ask that the clerks distribute Annex 2, which summarizes the key findings from this poll.
Please go ahead.
Members will see that the majority of the respondents who responded to this poll felt that the current state of race relations in Singapore was good or very good. About half agreed that Singapore's laws were adequate to protect racial harmony. 6% disagreed, and the rest were somewhere in between. Most agreed that it was both the government's and the community's responsibility to strengthen race relations. But what I would say to members is that this, what we have in Singapore, is actually not the natural order of things. Indeed, there's nothing natural about what we have in Singapore. We now have come to believe it to be natural. We have made it our second nature. But actually, it's not natural. Because human beings are wired to be tribal, based on identity. And that continues to be true in most places, many places around the world. If you look at many countries, they are organized on the basis of formal or informal racial or religious hierarchies. That is the natural order of things. What we have in Singapore is we changed the natural order and made that changed situation second nature for us. So this bill has to be seen in that context. And when we consider our approach to multiracialism and laws, it is also useful to look at the experience of other countries and see what we should do or shouldn't do. Let's look at the developed world. Again, some examples. The UK, US, and France have a majority white population, but also a long history of immigration. So they have been multiracial longer than Singapore has been independent. And race has been a flashpoint in these countries. Last year, the UK was hit with a wave of riots between July and August of 2024. The riots began with falsehoods. There was a knife attack that killed three young girls. Rumors were that the attacker was an asylum seeker, but in fact, the attacker was in fact born in the UK. By mid-afternoon on the day of the attack, the false name of the suspect had received more than 30,000 mentions on X alone. As of September last year, police had arrested more than 1,200 persons. This wave of riots is widely viewed as being among the most serious in British history. It exposed deep-seated racist sentiments and also other grievances relating to immigration. There have also been other riots in the UK arising from distrust between communities. There was a survey in 2021. That survey was conducted by King's College, University of Manchester, and the University of St. Andrews. The survey found that more than one-third of persons from minority groups in the United Kingdom had actually experienced racist assaults, meaning physical attacks. One-third. Turning to the US, we also see evidence that race and attitude towards racial issues seem to divide American society. You see the endless media reports on the issue, the protest marches, the violence. You get the sense that racial issues continue to be flashpoints. And if you turn to France, a report that was published in 2023 found that 91%, more than 9 in 10, of black people had been victims of racial discrimination, either often or from time to time. Reports of anti-Semitic, anti-Muslim acts increased by almost 300% and 30% respectively, while other types of racist acts increased by around 20%. Racial tensions are present and spill into serious violence, even in countries where people do not look very different from each other. If you look at the 1994 Rwandan genocide, it's one of several examples in Africa A more recent example is a crisis in Sudan, specifically the Darfur region. And as a result of the crisis, millions have been displaced from their homes. BBC recently described the situation in Sudan as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In our region too, many countries have faced serious, long-standing conflicts along racial lines, Myanmar being one of them. So looking across these countries, we see three issues. First, in allowing hate speech. Many of the countries I've cited as examples earlier, the United States, UK, France, they allow denigration of other races and religions. In the US, the Supreme Court has said that inflammatory speech, even speech advocating violence, can be protected. So in Singapore, we take a different approach. As I told this House in my ministerial statement in April 2019, if we do not have a tough set of laws and policies against hateful and offensive speech, the tone and texture of public discourse in our society will change over time. It will create an environment that is conducive for discrimination and eventually violence against people who can be classified in a specific category described by skin color or religion or some other attribute. And we must not let that happen here. I trust that on this issue, we are all agreed as to where we draw the line on hate speech, on speech which advocates violence, on speech which incites violence, on speech which seeks to set aside a group and target them as the out-group, as I said in my ministerial statement. The second lesson that I think we can learn is, and this is an age-old issue, the exploitation of race for politics. Race-related issues have immense power to mobilize people. Identity politics, basically. And it's deeply visceral. Politicians know it, and many exploit it to score political points and win elections. In recent years, you see a trend in many countries, including the West, politicians encouraging people to think along racial lines and adopt a us versus them mentality. And if this is repeated, both during electoral cycles and off electoral cycles, the racial divisions are then reinforced and become even more entrenched in society. We take a tough stance on this. Again, I trust all members will agree with us that the exploitation of race has no place in our politics. Third, social segregation. The neighbors we have and our day-to-day interactions with them affect how we perceive the wider society. Racially segregated neighborhoods limit opportunities to build trust between different communities. The University of California did a study in 2021, and it found that racially segregated residential neighborhoods in the United States remains the linchpin that sustains systemic racial inequality. This is a consequence of years of racial segregation, residential segregation based on race. And the issue is not unique to the United States. After the riots in 2001, the government in the United Kingdom commissioned a study. That study found that physical racial segregation of housing estates was a key contributor for the riots then. The report described most of the white communities as living, I quote, parallel lives, close quotes, from minority Asian and Black groups. It commented that, and I quote, there is little wonder that ignorance about each other's communities can easily grow into fear, close quotes. If you look at France, residential segregation can also be found in the banlieues. These are suburban areas predominantly inhabited by immigrant families, usually of Arab or other African descent. Around 5 million people, about 8% of the French population, live in areas classified as Bonlieu. The overlap of ethnic segregation in these areas with economic and social exclusion has led to increasing polarization between those minority marginalized groups and the majority in French society. Again, here we have done it differently in Singapore. Previous governments had the foresight to introduce the ethnic integration policy in our public housing estates, EIP. The EIP has ensured a mix of races in our public housing estates. If the government had left it to market forces, you would have seen Chinese, Malays, and Indians forming residential enclaves in different parts of Singapore. Similar to what is happening in many other countries, and similar to what was happening in Singapore before we introduced EIP. If that happens, soon schools in those areas will also become segregated. Children would have less diverse social circles and limited exposure to different cultures. They will grow up with less understanding, trust, and comfort with other communities. They will carry this into adulthood and into workplaces. We put in place rules to maintain certain racial proportions in public housing so that we would have mixing across races in every estate. And Singaporeans generally appreciate the intent of this policy. IPS conducted a survey in 2024, and 93% of the respondents agreed that it was important to have a mix of people from different races in each housing estate. In the light of these lessons, what's our approach to maintaining racial harmony? I'll say there are two aspects. One, you have to have a strong legal framework which sets clear boundaries on what is not allowed in Singapore. Second, with that framework in place, you have to have the government actively putting in place policies and platforms that maximize our common space to strengthen cohesion. Now, just a few words on that. The law can tell you what you cannot do. The law can't tell you, be nice to your neighbor. Form friendships and bonds with your neighbors across races, across religions. That's where policies come in. So the thousands of activities that are carried out every weekend, bringing people together, and multiplicity of events and approaches, of the way the schools are organized, every other aspect, it's too long to go into here, but that comes in to create opportunities for people to become friends or at least form understandings and dislike each other less where there is dislike and like each other more where there is some potential for like. And over time, we would say Singapore has progressed substantively on this front. So let me start with the first aspect, a strong legal framework. Our constitution guarantees that all persons are equal before the law and are entitled to equal protection under the law. So it's a responsibility of the government to care for the interests of the racial minorities. And minority representation in parliament is guaranteed through our GRC system. Other legislation also deal with these issues. Most recently, the Workplace Fairness Bill prohibits workplace discrimination based on some characteristics, including race. This means an employer cannot make an adverse employment decision because of the race of the job seeker or employee. A subsequent bill will lay out avenues for affected individuals to seek recourse when they feel they have been discriminated against, including racial discrimination in the workplace. Now, beyond that, of course, our penal code sets out what conduct is not acceptable, and that would include conduct in the context of race. And these laws have generally served their intended purpose, and the RH bill continues with that approach. And that tells us, the law tells us, what is it that we cannot do, or what remedies there are when something wrong has been done. The second part, the policies, platforms to expand and deepen our common space. If you look at 1965 and you look at today, you find that most people are comfortable with bonds across races. Singapore is in a much healthier place. There is understanding, there is appreciation, there is acceptance, and deep bonds across racial, religious lines. Of course, some people will still have some different viewpoints, but on the whole, it's a very, very substantively different society from what it was in the 1960s. Because we have been facilitating interactions between people of different backgrounds, and we do this very deliberately. It's not left to chance. And while I don't want to go into a discussion of the policies, maybe I can refer to a poll, the poll that MHA and MDDI conducted last year. It found that over 85% of respondents felt that race relations are better or the same compared to 10 years ago. Now, that's in the context where I think in many parts of the world, race relations have actually regressed. IPS and OnePeople.sg, OPSG, also conducted a study based on a survey last year involving 4,000 Singaporean residents. Mr. Speaker, sir, with your permission, may I ask the clerk to distribute Annex 3, which summarizes the key findings of this study.
Yep, please proceed.
Thank you, sir. This study found that nearly two-thirds, 65.4%, of respondents rated Singapore's racial and religious harmony as high or very high. Now, that's an increase of about 8% from 2018-2019, when 57.1% said that. The number of race-related incidents reported to the police has also largely remained stable over the years, at around 10 per year, though there are some years with spikes. The police have noticed, I have noticed, that whenever there are elections, the number of police reports spike. But, you know, we cannot take this state of affairs for granted. We are in an age when identity politics is on the rise globally, and we cannot cut ourselves off from the world. With that background, sir, I'll turn to the bill itself. Essentially, the bill has five aspects or five proposals. First, it brings over existing race-related offences in the Penal Code. Second, it introduces the CRI, Community Remedial Initiative, that gives the offender the opportunity to mend ties with the community that he was attacking. And we provide this as an alternative to the person being charged in court. Third, the bill seeks to establish a restraining order, RO, regime. Fourth, it establishes the Presidential Council for Racial and Religious Harmony to advise on matters relating to racial and religious harmony that are referred to it by the Minister for Home Affairs or by Parliament. Fifth, it introduces safeguards against foreign influence through race-based entities. The 2024 poll on racial harmony, which I referred to, shows that the public strongly support various proposals in this bill. Nonetheless, during public consultations, one common comment that we received was that this bill only prevents racial disharmony and it does not promote racial harmony. I can understand the perspective. What people want to see is something that will positively push people to be harmonious with each other across races. And I explained my point earlier. You cannot, by law, force people to get along better with each other. That has to come through government policies, through the framework, the structure of society, how we build that DNA into society over time. And that's what we've been doing. Laws play an important role in that, because if you allow bad behavior, then these policies won't succeed. Laws are there. They provide a very strong legal framework and people know we will enforce our laws, and therefore they reduce and deter bad behavior. And once you stop that bad behavior, amongst a small minority usually, laws are necessary usually only as regards a small minority of people, then if you don't allow for that behavior, there is a framework, and within that you can promote policies that will enhance racial harmony. I will refer specifically to two proposals in this bill, one relating to race-related offenses and the other the Community Remedial Initiative. My colleague, MOS, soon will cover the rest. First, on race-related offenses, they are covered under Clauses 39 and 40 of the bill. Clause 39 takes what is already an offence today, that's inciting violence under Section 267 of the Penal, 267C of the Penal Code, and it prescribes increased penalties for a subset of that conduct, where offenders do so on the basis of a belief about race. Clause 40 brings over the substance of existing race-related offences in the Penal Code, which deal with threats to racial harmony. These are Section 298, which concerns acts that wound the racial feelings of any person, and Section 298A, which concerns acts that promote enmity between racial groups. In bringing these offences over, we have made certain clarifications. In particular, we have received public feedback that the term, I quote, wound racial feelings, close quote, lacks clarity. Therefore, Clause 40, sub-clause 2, replaces the term wound racial feelings with objective descriptions, or at least more objective descriptions. It's essentially insults, vilifies, denigrates, threatens, or abuses on the basis of race. This provides greater clarity and probably narrows the scope of conduct that would make out an offence today. Wound racial feelings could potentially be subjective. We have also aligned these offences with the corresponding offences in the MRHA, as we take an equally strong stance in dealing with threats to racial harmony and religious harmony. First, the penalties for offences in this bill are the same as the MRHA. Second, we have also introduced defences for offences under Clause 40 that are already present in MRHA. These are the defence of private or domestic conduct, which allows people to have a safe space to express their views about race and religion in private or domestic settings. The defence of pointing out in good faith any matters for the purpose of bringing about a removal of those matters. And similar to the MRHA, there will also be extraterritorial coverage for race-related offences. If the offence is committed overseas but is targets Singapore and has an impact in Singapore, it will be covered. But we acknowledge that it may be difficult to enforce offences outside of Singapore, but it signals our commitment to protect our racial harmony, even when the threat originates outside of Singapore. That said, while there are offences in the MRHA that are tiered depending on whether the act is committed by a religious leader or a lay person, this bill makes no such differentiation for obvious reasons. The law today does not distinguish between different categories of offenders for race-related offences. The distinction we had drawn in the MRHA was unique because in the context of religion, it reflects the greater risk posed by the actions of religious leaders who exercise formal religious authority, and there is no equivalent in the context of race. Instead, all persons are held to the same standard, since the acts of any individual can threaten racial harmony. Again, this only reflects the existing law and does not expand the scope of criminal liability. Next, I'll move to CRI. Our starting point is this. Racial incidents harm both the victim as well as the ties between the races. And, you know, criminal prosecution sometimes may be necessary, but it cannot by itself mend the community ties. Thus, if you have an offender, he might be offered an opportunity to participate in community remedial programs as an alternative to prosecution. This is similar to the CRI and MRHA, and we seek to achieve two policy objectives. First, reconciliation. It provides the offender with the opportunity to make amends for his racist conduct. And hopefully, by that process, he or she gets a better understanding of the community that he attacked and hopefully creates a bond bridge and strengthens mutual understanding. Second, of course, rehabilitation. It gives the offender the opportunity to learn from his mistake. Clause 41, subclause 2 of the bill provides for the minister to appoint community partners to deliver the programs. And MHA intends to work with onepeople.sg and MCCY to design suitable programs based on the context of the different types of offensive conduct. And these programs will have three broad elements. First, raising awareness of how the alleged offender's racist conduct impacts others. Second, initiating action by requiring the alleged offender to make amends with the aggrieved individual and community through volunteer work and other suitable engagements. Third, by encouraging amity by arranging guided reflection sessions with the alleged offender and aggrieved individual or community. But as Clause 41, subclause 4 provides, it is not compulsory for an alleged offender to complete the programs, but failure to complete can be taken into account by the public prosecutor in exercising prosecutorial discretion. Such cases will continue to be directly referred for prosecution, and that's egregious cases. For egregious cases, they will not be offered the opportunity of CRI, so that a clear and strong signal is sent that such conduct will be treated severely. So, in our multiracial society, where diversity is woven into the very fabric of our identity, it is crucial that we continue to celebrate our differences while understanding and respecting one another. By fostering an environment of trust, empathy, and unity, we can build a future where everyone continues to feel a deep sense of belonging and pride in being Singaporean, regardless of race. Mr. Speaker, sir, what we are trying to achieve in Singapore is not easy. It is, in fact, very difficult and very hard work. But, you know, given that Singapore has always been a diverse country, many races, many religions, many languages, we had to and we wanted to, from this multiplicity, create one united people. But without suppressing any racial, religious, or linguistic identity. That has been, if I may say so, the genius of Singapore. From many, one, but without erasing multiplicity. We could not have done this without simultaneously fostering understanding and trust and acceptance amongst our many. And at the same time, making clear that we will not tolerate any bigotry or hatred or intolerance that threatens the one people that we have become. We're grateful for the progress we have made. Thanks to the pioneer and Merdeka generations of Singaporeans, but we know that we can do better, and we are trying to do better. The bill, as I've said earlier, will not be a panacea for solving all race-related challenges, but it's a powerful signal of our resolve to remain united as one people. Mr. Speaker, I seek the support of all members for this bill. Let us send a strong signal to all the nations of the world that 60 years after we gained independence, Singapore will remain a multiracial nation, that we will not be a Malay nation, a Chinese nation, or an Indian nation, and that every Singaporean will have his place here, and that he or she will be respected, and we will all be equal in language, culture, race, religion. MOS soon will now take the House through the remaining proposals in the bill. Thank you, sir.